state your name clearly and the party you represent, and that will identify yourself on the tape and also help us in the pronunciation of your names. So with that, we'll start with the first case, 2007-5049, Bayer versus United States.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bryce Wilcox. I represent the appellants, who are 46 former sugar beet farmers from Central Washington State. My clients are here before this court seeking compensation for the taking of their state law processor liens by the federal government, whose actions rendered the value of my clients' liens worthless. The sole issue before the court on appeal is whether the so-called super priority lien statute 7 U.S.C. 7484D effectuated a taking in this case under the Fifth Amendment that warrants payment of just compensation.
Do you agree that the federal government has the authority to limit the scope of state lien?
Limit the scope of state lien, Your Honor? Yes, I do.
So your theory is that every time the federal government does that, results in a taking, whether the lien limitation provision existed before the state lien was created or afterwards?
No, Your Honor. What my client's position is if the regulation of that lien effectuates or renders the lien completely valueless, then you have a taking. If the federal government does something less than that, then I can go into a partial regulatory taking analysis, which balances the factors set forth under the law.
But Lucas, the case on which you rely so heavily, makes clear that there's a difference between personal property and real property. And the personal property, at least from the point of view of state law, the personal property rights would be restricted.
Yes, I believe that is correct, Your Honor.
And so, if this restriction had been imposed by state law, there wouldn't be any problem, right?
Correct.
So, the only question is whether federal law somehow necessarily achieves a taking every time there's a limitation on the scope of the state lien, right?
I would only disagree with Your Honor to the extent that you indicated it was every time there's a restriction. I do believe that the federal government may restrict the state property right through appropriate regulatory measures. It's when those restrictions go so far that it completely eliminates the property interest, that is when you have the takings issue, and that is what occurred in this case. It wasn't just a restriction per se, it was taking the sole stick, if you will, out of the bundle of rights. That is mean priority. That's the only thing that the lien has value for.
But the enactment of the super priority statute didn't render the state liens valueless, right?
In this case, it did, Your Honor. In this
the enactment of the statute, not.
Oh, not the enactment of the statute. It was the application of the statute in this case.
And the creation of the state, of the federal super priority lien here, didn't in and of itself render the state lien valueless, right? It just made it subject to the federal.
Correct. And in this case, if, and this is a fact-specific case, if there were sufficient assets, hypothetically, to pay the government's super priority lien and pay in part my clients, then I think it would be a different analysis under a different constitutional test.
So it wasn't the creation of a federal lien here that rendered the state lien valueless, it was only the ultimate enforcement of the federal lien.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. As we focus on the two-part test utilized by this circuit in determining the taking, which is first the creation of a compensable property interest, and second, whether there is a taking, this case centers on the first issue, whether there was a compensable property interest. And as indicated in our submittals, property interests are created and defined by state law. The Constitution does not create property interests, it protects property interests.
Why doesn't the fact that the statute existed affect whether or not they have a cognizable property interest? I think you have a much more compelling case. I'm sure you probably agree with this. You'd have an easier case, wouldn't you, if the statute came after your lien?
Correct, Your Honor. And
so why doesn't the fact that it came first affect the extent of the property interest to your client?
The proposition that we are advancing in this case is that the federal government simply lacks the authority to legislatively redefine state-created property rights. So the fact that the federal government, some prior point in time, by decree, dictates that a state lien in this case, in the application, is valueless because it takes the lien priority away from it. That's simply the
Well, they didn't decree that the lien was valueless, but they decreed that the CCC lien would have priority.
Correct. It by super priority, what the federal government is saying is no matter what lien is out there and what sort of prior position that lien had vis-a-vis the government's lien, we're going to trump that. And unlike other property rights that have multiple sticks in the bundle, if you will, the lien only has one real value to it, one stick, and that's lien priority. If you don't have your priority as a creditor, then you really don't have anything.
Well, I mean, you say that, but that's because you're assuming the facts of this case, where the lien that the CCC had basically recouped and had to recoup all of the property right. But I mean, I imagine in some cases, and maybe I'm wrong, isn't it in some cases where CCC gets its money back and then the subsequent liens, or not necessarily subsequent time, but subsequent priority liens, also get either their money back or some share thereof? Isn't that also something that could happen?
It's certainly possible. And as I indicated, I believe that if that situation arose, we would not have a categorical taking under the Lucas analysis, where there's all value in the property is rendered worthless. We have a partial regulatory taking where some use, some restriction in value was created by the prior government enactment, which then requires the multi-factor test that the courts have articulated.
Well, here your lien was not categorically rendered valueless. It was simply an adjustment of priority.
Your Honor, the effect of the adjustment of priority is what you're complaining about.
That's simply a result of the economic conditions that surrounded this situation at the time, not as a result of the statute.
But I think, Your Honor, if we look at the other lien taking cases, Armstrong, Sheldon, Murray, and Metmore Financial, in a lien situation, if there weren't economic circumstances driving the issue, because that's where liens only become valuable, is where the entity to whom the debt or who owes the debt can't pay. And so by definition, you will have that circumstance arise.
But Armstrong is distinguished. That was a contract where there are different circumstances that came into play. And of course, I think the Armstrong case is clearly distinguishable from this one, where you have a statute that simply readjusts the priority of liens. And in Armstrong, you had the government action in acquiring title to this ship that, because of sovereign immunity, extinguished the lien holder's right to enforce that, which seems to be completely different circumstances.
And I would agree with Your Honor that Armstrong is factually distinguishable. The relevance of Armstrong would be into the economic circumstances. That's what drove the taking, in that case. That is to say, if there was not an economic crisis, if you will, you would not have had a lien issue because the subcontractor theoretically would have been paid by the general contractor, hence there would have been no taking. So it was the economic circumstance of the business transaction that created, if you will, the taking circumstance.
But wasn't it the fact that the sovereign immunity prevented the lien holder from enforcing it?
Yes.
It had nothing to do with economics.
My point, Your Honor, is that if it wasn't for the economic situation, that is, the general contractor not having the money, that's why the government came and took the ships back, is because they're having problems under their contract with the government. And by basically repossessing, if you will, the ships, now the subcontractor who had a materialness lien could not go and enforce that lien as it would otherwise be able to. So in that sense, Your Honor, it was the economics that really were underpinning the situation. And I think that was the same in the other cases as well.
Here we have a situation where at the time the sugar beets were submitted for processing, which gives rise to the state lien provision.
Yes.
Yes. Your clients either knew or they should have known if they'd done their research that there was a possibility that that lien would be subordinate to a later arising federal lien coming about as a result of a federal loan.
That was of record, correct?
Right. So why aren't they bound by it? Why isn't that, in effect, the background principle that existed at the time the property was acquired? And I'm surprised a bit that neither side cited our Commonwealth Edison case. But part of the decision of Commonwealth Edison says that where you're dealing with personal property, the question of what the background principles are, what the expectations are, so it is what the expectations are at the time the property was acquired. So here at the time the property was acquired, there was this federal rule about super priority. Why didn't they acquire their state lien subject to that existing background principle imposed by federal law?
Your Honor, I believe that that issue was addressed by this court in its en banc decision in Presalt, where the government attempted in that case to interject the history of the federal law, that is to say that the law related to
railroads. Yeah, that was a real property case. And even Lucas makes clear that personal property is very different. We don't really have to address in this case the question of what the real property situation would be. We're dealing with personal property. And even Lucas says that, you know, in the personal property situation, the same rule about categorical takings doesn't apply, right?
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree in the sense that I don't believe that the background principle analysis articulated in Lucas is clarified by Presalt only applies to real property. I mean, that's my client's position, is that the analysis of the real property cases in the categorical takings is equally applicable to the personal property arena. And I would at least point to the...
Well, that's a problem because Lucas says the exact opposite, right?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, that it says the exact opposite. I certainly acknowledge there's differences between real property and personal property. But in what I was... wanted to point out to, and I know I'm in my rebuttal time, so that in Nolan versus California Coastal Commission, that was a constructive notice real property case, and Justice Brennan in his dissent in Nolan had pointed to this issue about the agency having imposed similar restrictions on the 43 of the prior neighbors. In other words, the Nolans, according to the dissent, had noticed that they were taking the property, this real property, subject to these development conditions. Justice Brennan relied upon Monsanto, which is a case discussed in our brief, which was a trade secret case, not a real property case, utilizing the same logic advanced by the government in this case. And the majority then responding to Justice Brennan's dissent characterized Justice Brennan's statement as a peculiar proposition that a unilateral claim of entitlement by the government can alter property rights. And I think what's noteworthy, Your Honor, is that the majority in Nolan did not make the distinction between real property versus personal property when addressing Justice Brennan's comments.
Yeah, but in Monsanto, the court rejected the claim for a taking with respect to information that was submitted after the federal rule was changed, right?
It did, Your Honor, because the court found that there was a valuable exchange where Monsanto voluntarily disclosed its trade secrets in exchange for protection under federal law, which, of course, in our case, my clients wanted to engage in this valuable exchange where the super priority would be given in exchange for payment.
All right. You have pretty much consumed your rebuttal time, but I will give you 2 minutes. The other side has been. So thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear from your adversary, Mr. Martin.
favor, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning. Stephen Maker.
We'll give you an extra 2 minutes just to balance it out.
Stephen Maker from the Department of Justice representing the United States, Your Honor. May it please the court. In this case, plaintiffs and the critical issue in this case is whether or not plaintiffs possess a compensable property interest. Engaging in the antecedent inquiry in this case and attempting to define what property the plaintiffs possess with regards to their lien, as a matter of law, plaintiffs did not possess a property interest above the government in the proceeds of the sugar goods.
If the statute was enacted after their lien, would that have made a difference?
Yes.
Would the government be arguing then, or would they acquiesce that it was a take?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know hypothetically what the government's position would be, but I can say that it would be quite a difference from this case. It seems that the case law in those cases, you'd run straight into the difficulty that the Supreme Court talks about in United States versus Security Industrial Bank when they're determining whether to apply 552 retroactively or prospectively. If you're applying it in a sense where you're going back retroactively, the Supreme Court notes that there may be a takings issue there. So I think if this statute had, if this was a lien that had already arisen, and the sugar beet super priority statute had been passed, and those rules have been passed, then the government would, I don't think, be able to argue that there was no takings in that case. I think it's a very different case than this one. Because in this case, when plaintiff's liens arose as a matter of law, arising as a matter of law, they were already subject to the super priority statute. They were not acquiring a full priority lien. They were acquiring a lien that had a specific place and a specific position with regards to other liens. It's as though, by way of a basic analogy, if you go to an airport today, there are various lines. There's a line for frequent flyers and there's a regular line. Having a position in the regular line doesn't mean you have a position in the frequent flyer line with regards to getting to a ticketing agent. It's a rather simple analogy, but it does generally describe the situation here. In this case, not only are the 522 cases, such as In Re Thompson and In Re Lect, as we described in our brief.
I don't know how the two-line analogy really works. Isn't it more like you're in a line and the government butts in front of you?
No, because the government is in a separate line. I mean, maybe I tend to fly out of smaller airports where there's only one ticketing agent, but the government has, you're both trying to get to the same destination. You're both trying to get on a plane, but the government, because it has, in this case, have access on the frequent flyer line, it's not butting in front of you. In fact, there were, with regards to this case, the plaintiffs, there were individuals in their line in front of them also who had acquired their position as a matter of law with regards to where their lien stood. The government had what was a different kind of lien, a super priority lien, which took precedence over all sorts of other liens. So I don't think it's the government.
Why are you fighting my analogy? Why don't you just say something along the lines of, yes, the government butt in front, but there was a sign at the beginning of the line that said the government may butt in front any time it comes along.
Well, I don't agree with the analogy or that way of describing the analogy, but even if that is the case, you could say the government had a right to butt in front of you as a matter of law when you got to the airport from the outset. So, I mean, the analogy isn't necessarily, describing it in a different way isn't fatal to that case, but I would describe it a little differently. Plaintiffs further describe their takings as a categorical taking. There are additional issues in this regard, which I'll briefly address. However, I will note that whether or not this is a categorical or a regulatory taking, the question of the nature of the property interest is dispositive in this case.
Which is the categorical or not?
Well, it would appear in our view to be that they're alleging a categorical taking.
Well, it certainly
is. In fact, they state so in their briefs, effectively.
Yeah, they say that the enforcement of the lien created a categorical taking, but not the creation. Mm-hmm. Your view is that a categorical taking occurred?
It has difficulty placing itself in the categorical taking category because what the government is doing here is it is enforcing, assuming we have a pre-existing right, it's simply enforcing a pre-existing interest. And it's settled law that when you're talking about takings, it's not the action of the government with regards to security interests. That's sort of proprietary in nature, not sovereign in nature. And if it were, I mean, we're concerned with the nature of the government's interest, which would be sovereign in nature. I think the more appropriate focus case is whether or not the statute was a taking, whether the super priority statute was a taking, not merely the enforcement of the government's right. If the government had a right pursuant to the statute to enforce its priority, the enforcement of that statute is not a takings at all, in our view. And the cases which plaintiffs cite are generally distinguishable.
Assuming we disagree with you, the effect of the government's enforcement of the lien in this case extinguished the entire underlying property of the grower's lien and rendered that lien entirely worthless. Does that mean this is a categorical taking?
Well, I think analyzing it as a categorical taking makes a great sense, but we didn't distinguish all of the value of their lien. They still had their lien priority. It's just there were not enough proceeds to satisfy their lien. And there was not enough proceeds to satisfy all of the government's lien. If we go to the facts of this case, plaintiffs received
They still had their lien, but they had nothing, no underlying property.
They had nothing left to satisfy the lien, but the question of whether or not there's a taking doesn't depend upon whether or not there's enough money in the bank to worth it. We get that from Branch versus the United States.
The government action here that we should be focused on, is it the enactment of the statute? Is it the creation of the lien by the loan, guarantee loan, or is it the enforcement? What's the relevant government action?
The creation of the statute, Your Honor, which establishes lien priority, because subsequent the government is merely enforcing its right to its lien. It's again the case, if we're focusing upon the question of the government actually enforcing its right, we run into the problems that are detailed in Branch versus the United States, where ultimately the constitutionality of the government's action comes to depend upon the happenstance of the financial condition of the sugar beet processor. So we would state that the relevant portion to focus upon is the question of the lien priority statute. And that statute, again, only established priority. It did not establish or did not categorically take any property, simply put the government in its position. And it certainly did not establish or affect any property in existence at the time, at least at issue in this case. Unless there are any further questions. For these reasons, the reasons set forth in our brief, we respectfully request that the court affirm the decision of the Court of Federal Claims. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wilcox.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to follow up on two points, if I may. First, with respect to the issue of Lucas and whether the test therein would be limited to the real property setting, I would like to ask the court consider the portion of the Lucas decision, at least at page 1030 of the official site, where the court recites in part the rule that's announcing and then cites to Monsanto as a case. And I think at least inferentially that would suggest that although there is certainly a valid and real distinction between personal and real property, there is not necessarily in the Supreme Court's mind a reason to apply a different rule. And of course the Supreme Court has yet to resolve that question as to what is the appropriate rule in the categorical personal property arena. There's additional instructive language, I believe, in the United States versus Security Industrial Bank case, a 1982 Supreme Court decision, where the court held that the, quote, bundle of rights which accrues to a secured party is obviously smaller than that which accrues to an owner in fee simple, but the government cites no cases supporting the proposition that differences such as these relegate the secured party's interest to something less than property. Again, it does not directly address the court's question that I believe frames the issue as to whether or not there should be a different standard to personal property. Yeah, in closing, and I would just ask the court to look at the Federal Court of Claims decision cited in our brief, Store Safe Redlands, where the Federal Court of Claims engages in an analogy about what would happen if the government was allowed to prospectively limit property rights, real property rights. And I would take that one step further by the hypothetical of the government prospectively stating that automobiles were no longer property, just as a matter of federal legislation. And then after everyone sold their property, their car one time, would then the individual owners of cars be able to bring a takings claim under that statute?
Do you think that if we were to succeed in this case, that the government would continue to make loans under these circumstances?
I don't know, Your Honor, to be honest. I do not know. I believe that I didn't get time to go into the history of the Farm Act in my argument we did in the brief, but I believe that there was a legislative issue that created this situation where we had a just compensation clause in the statute when it was created, when the super priority statute was created. That just compensation clause, 1421 of 7 U.S.C., was suspended for the crop years 1996 to 2002. If it wasn't for that suspension, I wouldn't be here today because the super priority had with it a compensatory clause that Congress decided to suspend.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.